This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 27th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up on the show this week, our global tour of the season's big trade fairs continues as we hear from the IMM Furniture Fair in Cologne.
Let's help the people to select and arrange their things and homes in a beautiful way. It's about this old world of beauty. It's needed.
Then we go to Switzerland, where the world's finest watchmakers gathered in Geneva.
Clients are much more demanding. They're looking for new functionalities, they're looking to be surprised. So pushing the envelope internally is also challenging for our watchmakers. It stimulates them.
And then to Berlin, where Fashion Week does its best to compete with the big boys.
Berlin Fashion Week is great because it's young and because you can choose basically how to do things. It's still growing.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Last week, the furniture designers, makers and buyers of the world gathered for one of the industry's biggest jamborees, the IMM Furniture Fair in Cologne. We were there to see what's new and what legs, arms, corners and curves have everybody talking. It's been a big year for Swiss manufacturer Vitra. Early last year, it announced it would be acquiring Finnish brand Artek in an unprecedented deal. Many wondered what effect this would have, especially when it announced Artek's then managing director would move across to Vitra and head up its homes division. So, at IMM, eyes were on both brands' stands to see what would happen now that the dust had settled on the relationship. And at Vitra, visitors were in for a surprise. Gone was the white box it usually shows off its wares in, and in its place were plants, bicycles, plenty of framed pictures, and an eclectic collection of furniture. An altogether much homier environment. Does this signal a new direction for Vitra? I spoke to the new head of homes, Mirko Kuhlberg, to find out more.
Last year, July, when this whole thing came up, which was divided into two segments very clearly, so there's a Vitra home and Vitra office, so we started analysing how we should look, feel and sound and what is the tone and colours of this home section. And we have been working hard, and I think that we are finding the language for us.
Talk to us through the design of the booth, which, in terms of the accessories on it, the colour of it, the woods on the outside, it looks completely different to most things in the hall, but also to anything Vitra's ever done before.
We did the Vitra House Loft with Ilse Crawford, and that was a big inspiration for us. I think that we have to find a consistent way of working, and we sort of took as a reference the Vitra House. We turn it like and taking here to the fair. You know, it's very scary to bring like this kind of home feeling to the fair, and it may turn to be very artificial and superficial, but we manage it to wear well because we brought some materials and we really be able to make the collage with Vitra and Artek, which is making a big, big difference also for the whole look.
There's lots of Alvar Aalto in there, isn't there, which is nice to see.
Yeah, now all the big guys are together there, just with contemporary fellows there. We are designing new products for us.
Cologne is often seen as the fair where lots of sales are made. It's less about the kind of new creative designs and actually just where business is done. How have you tried to sort of soften that with creating an emotional stand?
I think that this is very commercial fair, and we were also thinking, like, should we bring in new products here, or what is the new products, or what is the new idea? So we basically decided to bring more like a conceptual approach for the fair, and same time we have a very, very strict approach about analyzing with whom to work for the future. I think the dealer and the distribution network is something which need to be also revamped. Sometimes companies don't focus on that, they are selling like a, more like a quantities and not sort of the quality-based thing, how the presentation is. So for Milan, there will be coming new products again.
And how do you think sort of creating a nice atmosphere and creating the sense of home on a booth like this is important to business? And why is this happening now? Why do you think the market's changing, that the buyers and clients that come want to sort of see how furniture works in a space and helps make comfortable lives and make them feel at home?
I think it's super tricky. I have been now traveling quite a lot around the world and trying to see how does a furniture store look like and how our sort of dealers present the products and where you really would be thinking that the future consumer would like to go, because you could buy everything from online as well. So why bother to go into a furniture store and these kind of halls of furniture as like a massive big stores? Why sort of enter in these ones? So I think it's very much about the spirit, what's this kind of immaterial feeling when we go there, and you kind of see like it, there has to be like the service. I think that service is going to be a super important factor, and all this kind of personalization, customization, you just can't think that we would be buying the same kind of things that our neighbors. We expect a lot from the store. We expect like everything for all senses, and you know, there are a lot of also this kind of lifestyle stores which were coming where you there are curated fashion. There's a bookstore, they created like cafes, furniture, design, everything vintage and new. But we have also seen those quite a lot, actually. Surprisingly, they are popping up everywhere. So it's a question about expertise. We really want people to help us to make the best choice. And I think that we need to be really talented, professional people to work with the customer service. I think that is the biggest thing for the future. We have to have the knowledge about the product, but it's not about the technical information. It's more like this kind of psychological skills what the sales teams are needed. And what I want to create here is like kind of freedom of choice. We're talking here at Vitra Home about this kind of Eames quote about select and range. Let's help the people to select and arrange their things and homes in a beautiful way. It's about this old word of beauty. It's needed.
It's almost an exercise in staff training as well, so that Vitra staff see the furniture that they sell all the time in a, you know, cold showroom, actually how it works in a house. And that's important when they relate it back to the customer.
Hey, come on, we have to bring passion to this business. And easily when you are in a big successful company, you start to getting very rational, making the packages for the dealers and in a way solving this kind of your turnover sort of targets. But we need to sort of think about how our dealers are able to sell out the products. My boss is outside on the street. It's a consumer. I said, that's the only person which I need to really please. And that's what I think we need to sort of also educate our team to really focus and relax a bit.
That was Mirko Kuhlberg, Vitra's head of homes at the brand stand at Köln Furniture Fair. And a bit more from Vitra next week on Section D when we headed to Paris for the Maison et Objet Homeware Design Fair in Paris. One of the main events at this year's IMM in Köln was Living Kitchen, the biannual showcase where the great and the good of the cuisine industry get together to launch their new pieces. It's an international gathering, but it's heavy on the German brands, as you might expect, with global leaders Bosch, Miele and Siemens all present, showing everything from cupboard systems to kitchen ranges. One of the highlights was Gaggenau, the Black Forest-based brand. I caught up with the company's head of brand design, Sven Backer, to talk about Gaggenau's new launches.
So here we are at your booth, which is farmhouse inspired, isn't it? If you could tell us, describe to us where we're sitting.
I think we're just sitting in the middle of, let's say, the courtyard, and we just look around and we see those different areas where formerly in this old kind of farmhouses, there were those different things were manufactured. We have the bread maker on the one hand, formerly we had those different kind of craftsmen working there, and that's a little bit of story we want to tell here. You can see the different appliances, you can also taste the food. That's the story we want to tell here.
Colin, it's a massive, massive trade fair. How do you try and get people's attention with your booth?
I think it's exactly that. What we try to do is we don't try to be anyone, we are ourselves. We are Gaggenau, we are real. You can touch it. We're just sitting here on real wood. It's not fake. It's real stone. It's there's no fake materials, and that's exactly what the brand is all about. Even it's only a fair and not a permanent showroom, we do the same thing that we also do in our showrooms in London or in Paris. And I think that's something people really like because it's nothing artificial.
And it's a brand born in the Black Forest, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It's the Black Forest, and it's over 300 years old. So it's very old. It was an old forge. They did hammer work and stuff like that. So it's still, the people in the Black Forest were saying they were very inventive. So that's what it's all about. And what they also have there is wood, a lot of forest, obviously. So everything fits together. And also, if you know, maybe the cuckoo clock is also an invention from the Black Forest. So that's also something maybe you know.
And Gaggenau, it's a company known for its heritage and its tradition, but also for its innovation and sort of pushing forward technologically. Would you mind talking us through some of your favourite new pieces at the stand? Particularly, I love the self-cleaning oven that you're launching.
Years ago, we just brought the steam oven to the domestic kitchen. And over the years, we constantly improved the whole product. And one thing that was really difficult was the cleaning process. So we invented something. It's very easy. After you did your cooking and everything, you just have a little capsule that you put inside to close the door, to press on, and then it's a self-cleaning mode. It's like a little bit like a dishwasher and everything. After a few amount of time, it looked like a completely new appliance. And that was something that wasn't possible before, so that's a brand novelty, a very novelty for the market.
Obviously here at the fair, I mean, we're sharing it with lots of, you know, furniture brands. And for them, it's quite easy to, you know, producing brand new collections each season, brand new pieces of furniture. Obviously, kitchens move a little bit slower than that. What is the pressure to kind of bring out new technology and bring out completely new systems to wow buyers, press, that kind of thing?
I think you're absolutely right, because there are different trends and shapes you can react to. And of course, lifestyle is changing. But I think we have a lot of customers that have those appliances for many, many years. So, for example, we change our oven a series only every 8 to 10 years. So it's a very long development. It's not so much about trends that we really have. In the last years, we had only few really, let's say, technological novelties. And we only are doing them if they really make sense for the customer. Because we want to have the customers to have the joy of cooking. And not playing around with gadgets and blinking lights and funny TFTs and fuzzy apps. You really can touch everything. And so sometimes a lot of people ask, oh, what's new? Is there something new? Sometimes you say, no, everything is like it is. And of course, technology-wise, it's sometimes a huge invest when you buy Gaggenau appliances. So you don't want to change them all the time. So that's it.
Talking slightly of trends, I mean, we've got the new color over here, this anthracite, which is lovely. Talk us through the thinking behind that color.
Talking about of colors, we are not a very colorful brand. So most of the colors we have are quite natural. It's the colors of the materials we use. So we use stainless steel, aluminum, and we use glass. And the new series we have is the anthracite series that fits a little bit more perfect into the modern kitchen. So it's very reduced. So we have those two lines. We have those 200 series that's quite flat and it's very decent. And then we have the 400 series that's more strong. And if you can have it also in stainless steel. And then it's a very prominent, let's say, hard piece of your kitchen.
And here we are. I mean, as you say, sort of Gaggenau is a brand that's known for doing things very simply and very well, which is a real sort of German tradition, I think, isn't it? It's, you know, not, there are no tricks, there's no bells, there's no whistles. It's just good quality, well-made and well-designed items.
Yeah, that's what I think. It's kind of a cliche, but it's right, I think. It's really a quite German way of thinking. It's really a kind of, let's say, also in the tradition of the Black Forest people, a way of thinking of doing everything 110%. And also for the design, what for us is very important is that it's not only a technical intervention or invention. We work very closely at the early stage together, designers and the engineers, and also with end customers or chefs, to really get a very good product. And not only get a product that looks nice and the function is bad, or the other way around. And that's a challenge, because sometimes there are different things meeting. They don't really go align quite well with each other. So there's a lot of talking and understanding for the disciplines. And that's a challenge for us.
Mm. And do you think that's where the market is at the moment, both in sort of the domestic market and in the hospitality sector? But actually it's about simplicity, and it's about just things that do things very well, rather than, you know, all these mod cons and gadgets was actually used once and then probably never again.
Yeah, I think that's also a trend. What I also see, because we have some bakers here and they're just doing bread, German bread. The Germans are very special with their bread, so that's one thing. But you don't need so much things on that. It's also very simple. And when I think of these trends of, I just heard about all those kids just buying vinyl and LPs and records back in the days. It's only about also the experience of something. It's not, you want to feel the things, you want to see what's happening, and this digital thing, there is, let's say, a counter-revolution about that. So you really want to have this natural feeling once again. So this is maybe why we also do stuff like that here.
So next time we'll be seeing fire and logs here at your booth?
Yeah, maybe. But I think when you see this kind of let's say a trend of shabby and stuff like that. When we started in 2010, we just brought in Milan. We brought our home factory. Absolutely, we just brought it to the fair. Our logo, 15 meters long, we just detached it and just brought it to the fair. It was fantastic. But now you see it's a kind of a trend that everyone's doing that. So we're doing it, it's really real. But I think for the next time, we will see it's something totally different.
Yeah.
So because you always have to keep moving in a way, but still to be true to yourself, of course.
Yeah. And obviously we mentioned earlier, you showed at Eurocucina in Milan last April. What's the difference between showing in Milan and back here on home turf in Germany?
I think Milan is, it's Milan. It's, I think it starts with the weather. It's April, everyone's happy. Everyone looks nice because it's really the kind of feeling, you know, when you've been there, you really know what I'm talking about. And it's talking about design. Bella figura. Everything is about design. And here in Cologne, it's more about, also about business.
Yeah, and that, getting orders.
That, yeah, yeah. Getting orders, and you feel it. Although we have the same kind of story, of course, to tell, but it's different people and different things, but it's still nice. You also have a lot of things called the Passagen around there, so it's, I don't know what is, I don't want to have a ranking or so, but for us, to get it in one sentence, Milan is about the brand and about design, and here it's about the product and the business.
That was Sven Backer, Gaggenau's head of brand design, talking to me there at the brand stand at Living Kitchen at IMM in Cologne.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles and fresh thinking from the Monocle editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finished paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
As we've heard in the last few weeks here on Section D, the new season of festivals and shows has kicked off for 2015. These will roll on until March, when the world's design press and buyers will descend on China for Design Week in Shanghai. The beating heart of the event there is undoubtedly Design Shanghai, which saw 40,000 visitors attend last year's event. Although there is very much an international steer of brands wishing to enter the ever-important sector in China, there's plenty to discover in the way of homegrown talent too. To discuss all, I'm pleased to say I'm joined by Ross Irwin, co-creative director of Design Shanghai and creative director of Infrastructure, the Hong Kong creative agency. So let's look back at last year's event. How did it go?
It was phenomenal. It was obviously the first one that we'd done, Design Shanghai. And we were expecting, you know, a good turnout, but nothing like the amount of people that actually came to the show. Mm. The city really embraced the whole design event. It was as if there was a buzz about the city during the whole 4 days that the event took place.
We look at the calendar now, it seems like every city in the world has a design week, which is fantastic. But obviously China is a very peculiar and kind of new market for the design industry, but a very important one. How do you, in your role as creative director, kind of make the fair stand out?
Well, I think that's a really valid point, because there have been quite a few design show attempts, and I say attempts in China because I've visited many of them, and they didn't have the overall experience that we created with Design Shanghai. They didn't have the caliber of designers and brands that we had, as well as the features and the installations that we worked with. We worked with a lot of local creatives, including some artists, and did different installations throughout the whole exhibition area. We worked with local F&B partners, and we had a cafe, we had a restaurant. And what we would do as creative directors would actually work with some of the design brands and create a space using the furniture from the designers. So it wasn't just a cafe or a restaurant, it was actually a design cafe or restaurant. So basically, as people came into the show, they had an experience from the start to the end, and they went away with something slightly educational as well with the seminar content that we had. We had some great speakers, local architects, designers, international designers. Last year, we brought Ilse Crawford out to do the talks, which was fantastic. And this year, we've got some even better speakers coming out. Amazing cast of speakers. We have Jaime Heon, which I'm very glad to invite over. I've worked with him in the past. He's really well respected within China, and that's going to be fantastic. Eric Levy is coming over. We're working with Sarovsky with Prologue, which is Fredrickson Stallard. So the boys are coming over for that. We've got some local designers. Andre Fu will be coming from Hong Kong. Lee Broom, I think he's on the list. And I think more recently, Marcel Wonders is talking also about coming out. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a good line. And there's plenty more as well.
And who in terms of the actual sort of brands in the fair?
This year, we've got Moroso, which is one of my favorite Italian brands. So that's great. We have Foscarini. Hay will be coming back. They showed with us last year, had a huge success. Vitra are showing for the first time in China. And who else? Fritz Hansen, Saletti. There's some really great names. We've got galleries as well coming out to exhibit in the Collectible Hall. Mm-hmm. And we've got the likes of David Gill and various galleries from Paris coming over. Last year, they came over with beautiful 20th century pieces from Prouvé and various designers. It was stunning. Very well received.
I've read that 90% of the brands that showed there last year were showing in China for the first time. Mm. How important is this fair to sort of introduce these brands to the Chinese market? And how important would you say for people like Vitra is the Chinese market now?
China's changing really quickly. I've been in Hong Kong now 7 years, working within the design field. And when I arrived, there was so little interest in the way of design. And that was even in Hong Kong. So things have come a long way. And I think that these brands, such as those that have been mentioned, they have a really fantastic opportunity to really penetrate that market because it's such a growing market as far as the amount of households, new homeowners, the development. Obviously, we're putting this show on to offer to the property developers, the architects, the interior designers, and people who just have an interest in design, some of the best brands from around the world. Mm. But I think it is a really, really important time. If we had done this 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe we wouldn't have had the same response. But I do believe that the Chinese market is hungry for newness and newness in design and art.
I wonder if it sort of matches the kind of the fashion market there, which, you know, is getting more and more sophisticated. And it's, you know, although we like to think that they're only interested in sort of the Louis Vuittons, the big branded brands, it's actually, they're becoming increasingly sophisticated and
absolutely,
you know, they don't want to go for the predictable things. Is that the same in design? Are they sort of not interested in Eames Designs classics and actually they're getting more mature as a market?
Yeah, for sure. It's really evolving. And I think that, you know, a lot of the people that are buying from these brands 10 years ago possibly were looking at the brands that everyone was focused on. But they're slightly bored with the same old brands that they've been buying for the past 10 years. And they're looking for that point of difference. They're looking to be a little bit more individual and unique in the way that they live and what they have in their home, as well as what they dress. And I think it really is a growing market because there's a lot of people that have been traveling extensively over the last 10 years to Europe and the States. And, you know, when they stay at these hotels or they go to these restaurants, they want to live that experience in their homegrown land. And that's what they're doing by coming to the show and buying into these design brands.
If you could make a very, very broad generalization, what sort of brands or style does well in mainland China? Is it the Italians? Is it Scandinavians? Is it the old big names? Is it?
I think what's interesting is that there's room for everyone because it is such a huge market. And I look at Hong Kong and how when I came to Hong Kong with, you know, the likes of Tom Dixon and Jaime and Ilse and various other people, it took time. It took a year and a half for even that market to start buying into those brands. But it became very strong very quickly. And I think likewise in mainland China, you have the young sort of new homeowner that loves the Scandinavian look. So those brands would do very, very well. You have people that are looking for something a little bit more quirky, maybe like for, you know, Lee Broom's designs, for example. There's a lot of collectibles. There's a lot of people that like limited editions. So they'd go for sort of the more higher end products. And then we have a classic haul. It's not really the stereotype classic as we would imagine in England. It just means it's not so contemporary as some of those brands like Moroso. And that's also doing very, very well in the market.
And obviously, big trade fairs and things like this are very important to bring
foreign brands to one country, but there's also a certain responsibility to help bolster the local market as well.
Exactly.
What sort of do you plan to do to sort of help local Shanghai designers or Chinese designers? How involved are they?
We had a number of designers and brands at last year's show, and we're increasing that this year. Obviously, what we want to do being a new show is to sort of bring something different to the market. Hence, we want to bring the best of the European and American brands to China. But one of the other things that we're doing in 2015 is I'm working closely with AD China. And what we're attempting to do is to actually put a platform together for emerging designers. It's been done in the fashion world quite extensively. And I personally, I've had an interest in sort of finding local talent for a number of years since being in Hong Kong. And I think it's really important at this point in time to actually nurture and grow those young talents. So we're taking a space within the show and looking at around 10 or 12 local designers, local meaning, you know, throughout the whole of China. And not just putting on a competition, but also sort of mentoring them. So having a sort of panel of people that are from the industry that can actually mentor those designers. Because just like fashion, I think, you know, 3-5 years from now, some of the biggest names in design, I'm pretty sure will be Chinese.
Ross Owen, Co-Creative Director of Design Shanghai, thank you very much for joining me on Section D.
Thank you.
Thank you. Still to come today, we head to Melbourne to meet lighting designer Christopher Boots, check out the very latest in luxury watch design in Geneva, and see if Berlin Fashion Week has what it takes to be on the world's fast and furious fashion circuit. And now to Australia. The distinct sculptural lighting design of Christopher Boots have enjoyed increased international attention in recent years, with his self-titled Australian practice capping off 2014 with a successful collaboration with French luxury label Hermès. Monocle correspondent Nolan Giles paid a visit to Christopher's studio in Melbourne's Fitzroy and asked him to take us through some of the ideas behind his handcrafted creations.
The themes that I was originally kind of looking at were sort of based on very much patterns that would occur throughout nature. So, I mean, digressing slightly through the materiality, you know, there's a lot of use of, you know, quite literally raw stones, a very reductive use of material. There's a lack of colour and there's like a purity throughout the actual material that's being used. So I guess the hallmark, or at least the running theme that would come through everything, is that focus on materiality, you know? And for me, looking at the ways that we have these different things coming through in nature, you know, how does DNA branch? What does that look like? How do we translate that into an object? What does it feel like to be encircled by, like, a halo of light that we see at nighttime, you know? Like, all these kinds of things sort of permeate. It might be the originating start, whether or not anyone can see that on the other end. You know, that's a whole other story. You know, everyone takes their own interpretation to things. But for me, I've always been intrinsically informed by everything that I've seen in nature.
And obviously that is something that your clients do appreciate, because it seems like your business has grown fairly rapidly. Can you sort of take us through this really quick development of your company?
Yeah, it has grown. I mean, it really just started out with me and, like, asking a friend of mine to help me out on the occasional day. And before we knew it, I was like, hey, do you want to work full time? So it's been a very incremental yet sustained kind of growth. In terms of clientele, you know, recognizing that kind of aesthetic and that feel, you know, it resonates with the right people. You know, we don't push our product. People come to us when they want it. And I think that maintains that kind of authenticity. And it's a really nice, respectful balance with clients as well, you know. And I'm also, I have to say, quite lucky enough to say no to projects at this stage, which aren't quite as aligned with our kind of like themes or our process. And, you know, we've had some really, really beautiful clients, you know, open briefs, open budgets. It's rare, it's very rare. And for that, you know, we're really grateful.
Have there been any jobs that have been particularly memorable, jobs perhaps where you've really had a lot of creative freedom and come out with an outcome that's really sort of, you know, impress the client, impress yourselves even?
Yeah, there's been a couple, but probably the most notable project we've had of late was our collaboration with Hermes, which we installed in November 2014, just gone. So that was a 12-month collaborative process, and Hermes approached me to do the holiday windows in Madison Avenue, New York, for the men's and the women's stores. And the scariest thing about that was an open brief. It was an entirely white sheet of paper. And I mean, we had the theme Metamorphosis, which Hermes had run for 2014. And yeah, I sort of interpreted that in my own sort of world as being an evolution of consciousness and trying to sort of like bring that down in these little vignettes throughout the seven windows that we had to do. And I mean, to the credit, it's incredible they allow, you know, artists and designers to have carte blanche and to create what they like. And quite often I was like, always asking, oh, is this kind of okay? And they're like, well, it's up to you. What do you want to do? And I was like, okay, cool. Maybe we can kind of go this way. So it was a really lovely process that, you know, someone can entrust me to kind of really push it. So yeah, I have to say that was pretty awesome.
You've become known for your AWP light.
Oh yeah.
Apparently.
Oh, okay, great.
Could you take us through the AWP light and maybe share with us what makes that particular product special?
The AWP light itself is based on sacred geometry. So I guess from a designer kind of like standpoint, you know, I'm always quite been interested in like the reductive use of line and how minimal you can get in terms of like being able to create space. So that's where the AWP really came from. It's been what I would call a very testing product. It took us quite a few years in order to really perfect it. There's a lot of sort of like dovetailing, lots of very delicate joins. You know, the shape in itself exudes a demand for perfection and attention. But when you actually come down to it and you've got welded and brazed metal and like corners and angles, like it's a lot of work. And at the end of the day, simplicity is the hardest thing to achieve.
And obviously you're still having to work in a physical sense with machinery and things like that. Can you maybe take us through that process? How do things happen in the workshop and what are the sort of collaborations that you have, I guess, between your staff and yourself and just generating ideas and then actually generating the physical items?
I guess it's a very interdependent process. It's kind of, you know, it's based around sort of like a concept that I might have or a client might approach us with something that they want to do. We'll start going through this process of either using sketches or some very basic models to test things like scale and proportion and form. We'll obviously work through our sort of like materials palettes, which is pretty much based around brass, bronze and copper, and obviously other components like quartz, sometimes steel, palladium and gold. And so in a way, we sort of mix all that together. You know, the production team spends a lot more time, I guess, at the coalface in terms of making items. So we'll sort of have this bouncing back process, you know, whether or not something is physically possible or not, how far we can stretch things. So, you know, trialing through prototypes is really strong for us. And we always trial at full size with full material. It is a very expensive way to work, but the item ends up perfect at the end. You know, and quite often you can discover things through by making it in that way, in ways that you couldn't just going from, say, CAD and then, you know, getting something delivered. Like, it just doesn't work like that.
I'd be really interested to sort of hear how conducive Melbourne, this part of Melbourne perhaps, has been to your craft and your development. And obviously you've stayed here for a reason.
I first moved to Collingwood Fitzroy, actually, when I was 18, going to university. And at that time, Fitzroy was actually quite a hub for a lot of creatives. But gradually, as the years passed, you know, like Fitzroy is very close to the centre of Melbourne. And so the natural process of gentrification has actually shifted out a lot of creatives further out. And so the, I guess, creative spaces have just become smaller as time has gone on. But still that kind of like feel of, you know, this kind of unique or curated kind of like experiences that you can find in Fitzroy has still sort of come through, you know, now through retail, through a lot of cafes, you know, even the graffiti, for want of a better way to look at it. I'm just really grateful that I've got a really amazing team and that I'm really lucky to be, you know, in Melbourne. You know, it's been it's an incredible city to harbour and to foster creatives as well. And it might not necessarily be the world stage, but my perception of it is, you know, in a way an incubator kind of city, which allows people to kind of reach some sort of point. And it's got a, you know, it's an educated populace that can recognise design, which is really, it's just really critical to allow it to continue.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, where we'll be back straight after this.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story. Sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Hello and welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Next up, Monocle's Matt Alagai hopped over to Geneva last week for the SIHH, the major annual horological salon, to see what high-end watchmakers have been getting up to over the past year. This is where some of the biggest brands in the industry launch their new timepieces and establish the trends that will govern the next 12 months. So stay tuned, or should we say, watch this space.
I'm standing in one of the vast halls of the Palexpo Exhibition Centre in Geneva on the first day of SIHH, the city's annual watch fair and the forerunner to the much larger Basel World in March. With the world economy struggling, emerging markets slowing, and the Eurozone on the verge of deflation, you might be excused for thinking luxury watch companies might be feeling the pinch. But the optimism here is palpable, and some of the industry's biggest brands are out in full force here in Geneva.
I believe the watchmaking industry is now entering a new cycle.
This is Arnaud Carrez, International Marketing and Communications Director for Cartier.
As you know, the industry has benefited from tremendous growth over the last 10 years. I think we are now entering a new period, a new cycle, where I think it will be challenging for some brands. I definitely see Cartier becoming more and more powerful. This is really thanks to the reputation of the Maison, to its unique positioning on the watchmaking market, to the value of the Maison. People, especially in this current environment, people are very discerning and very careful about the brands they will purchase. They want value, and Cartier is the best investment for them.
It's certainly true that consumers in the luxury watch market are becoming ever more discerning. Across the hall from Cartier is Audemars Piguet's booth, and that's where I spoke to Octavio Garcia, the brand's art director. He told me that customers' demands are encouraging watch manufacturers to develop into new areas. But is this a clear trend across the industry?
Well, in fact, I have a tendency to say that in the watch industry, trends are not really that visible. Although we could say, for example, that many manufacturers are more and more focused on women's watches. This is something that's sort of emerging and sort of transforming itself. More and more mechanical movements for women. So a lot of attention and focus on the ladies' market in general. Otherwise, I would say that there is also a focus on complicated movements, very complex pieces with many, many different functions. That is also something that is probably from an engineering point of view, the most fascinating thing.
Why do you think that those trends are happening? I mean, why is there this new focus on women's watches and the more complicated models?
Well, I think in regards to the complicated pieces, there's always been a sort of arms race towards making things challenging our clients. I think that ultimately that's what it is. I think clients are much more demanding. They're looking for new functionalities. They're looking to be surprised, and brands understand that. So pushing the envelope internally is also challenging for our watchmakers. It stimulates them. So I think having this sort of oscillation between expectations from clients and pushing internally is something that's always sort of been natural in the watch industry.
While some brands are trying to predict the future of the market and looking to surprise customers with increased complexity, others are returning to their roots. IWC Schaffhausen released a new edition of their iconic Portuguesa line. I spoke to the company's marketing director, Goris Fairburg, who told me about how to update a classic design.
The Portuguese line is our iconic line. It's our biggest line in terms of sales. It's our most prestigious lines in terms of complications that we have on it. And it's also, we believe, iconic because the case design really hasn't changed since 1939. And it has been very iconic, very special, sophisticated at the time with its satined and polished surfaces. And it has proven timeless. And yes, so here we are, 75 years and having a very successful line that we can work on.
I mean, it seems to me, you know, just looking around SIHH this year, that lots of the other companies are going for much more complicated versions and lots more dials. And you seem to have dialed it down, as it were. You've taken away a level of complication and gone for a really classic look. Was that intentional?
First of all, I think it's in the DNA of the Portuguese line that it's no frills, very pure design, easy to read. Also the heritage, it was the first Portuguese, was from 1939. And it was actually based on a pocket watch movement. It was commissioned by two Portuguese businessmen who said, I want to watch as accurate as a marine chronometer, where we said, okay, the small diameters at the time, they don't deliver the accuracy. So we actually based it on a pocket watch movement. And then we also took the dowels from the pocket watches, which were at the time very clean, very sober, very clear of any unnecessary lines. And this DNA we have kept throughout the 75 years, so it's still in its DNA to have a clean and pure design, so no need to have a lot of guilloche or decoration on it.
But SIHH is not just an opportunity for brands to showcase their new designs to journalists. There are also buyers here. Charlie Pragnell owns a jewellers in Stratford-upon-Avon in the UK called George Pragnell. He told me about some of the design developments and new materials that he is keeping an eye on.
I think that there's certainly a move to try and develop a lot of mechanical hand-wound watches into automatic. That is certainly a demand from almost all collectors and watch buyers around the world. And that's been a consistent evolution. And the watch houses are developing in that direction. And I mean, even Jaeger-LeCoultre, who we've just seen, have managed to develop a watch movement in the Ladies Duetto, which is a dual faced watch, reverso, and that is now an automatic watch, which is a very huge challenge in a watch case that's that size and that shape. So that's certainly a continued development. I think rose gold continues to be increasingly strong year on year, and we're starting to see yellow gold start to make a comeback, which is for a more fashion conscious consumer, because these things go in circles. We're seeing a bit of the 70s and 80s coming back in that regard.
So while some brands are hoping to blaze a trail for the future at this year's show in Geneva, many are also looking back. And indeed, these seem to be the two pillars of the modern watch industry, heritage and technology. Customers around the world are demanding both, and it's up to brands to find the right balance. So as the market shifts, it'll be interesting to see which direction they all choose to take. As always, only time will tell.
That was Monocle's Matt Allegaier bringing us that from the SIHH Watch Fair in Geneva. And to end the show, we get back on the catwalk this week. Milan, Paris, New York and London dominate the scene, but smack in the middle is a little-noticed underdog. Berlin Fashion Week, which finished last week, is now in its 16th season, but remains in transition. While there's lots of local talent to discover, the event is an uneven affair. Big out-of-town brands fly in starlets for the red carpet, while scenesters parade in the lobby of the Fashion Week tent quaffing champagne. Some of the country's biggest labels, like Escada and Hugo Boss, have left Berlin Fashion Week to show in more glamorous or organised settings. But, as Susan Stone reports, a new generation of designers is striving hard to make its mark in the German capital, and may soon get some help.
The night before Berlin Fashion Week kicks off, Bobby Colladay is making the final checks on his fall 2015 collection here in this post-industrial atelier in the Wedding neighborhood. He's about to make his debut at Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week Berlin.
I think one of the key pieces of the whole collection is this hybrid coat. And basically, it's a coat that looks like two coats that have been fused together. On the one side, we've got a patchwork embroidered Minvenda fabric. It's from the northern part of South Africa, from a small former hometown called Venda. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's a very communicative piece of fabric because every single embroidered line here, every single patchwork piece here, all the dots, all the colors, they all have a symbolic meaning. They don't make clothes out of it in most cases. Most of the pictures I've seen are just of women who've wrapped it around their bodies with a strap around the shoulder. And, you know, it's just draped over the body, which I think is, you know, still a very beautiful, maybe primitive way of putting textiles onto the body. That's why one half of this is also just draped over the shoulder. It's only got one sleeve. And the other half of the coat is made of wool. And it can all be tied together by this silk belt. And once it's tied up at the back, all of a sudden it looks a bit like a kimono. So there's lots of cultural referencing going on here.
The German-Nigerian designer has been buzzed about since April 2013 when he boldly launched his own label concurrently with the show of his graduate collection from the fashion program at Berlin's Weissensee Art Academy. Since then, he's been doing things his own way, in his own time, and avoiding Berlin Fashion Week. Now, he's ready.
This is a full-on collection. You know, we've got shoes, we've got collaboration for earrings, we've got, you know, about 30 looks. We've got an amazing location, the Halle at Berghain, great models, a great cast, improvements in cut, a great team. It feels like, you know, we're there, sort of, yeah.
And do you think Berlin is there as a fashion place?
No, I don't think Berlin is there yet, but I think we're getting there. And I don't think Berlin, to be honest with you, I don't think Berlin has to get there. I think, you know, Berlin Fashion Week is great because it's young and because you can choose basically how to do things. It's still so, let's say, still growing.
Soul searching was a trend at this year's Fashion Week, almost as prevalent as the catwalks and champagne. At the rebuilt Hohenzollern Palace, known as Kronprinzenpalais, the biannual Zeit magazine Fashion and Style Conference, this year co-hosted by Vogue, was full of questions. The main one was, why must Berlin be a fashion city? Discussions were presented by both publications' top names.
Herzlich willkommen, Christiane Arp und Tilman Prüfer.
Speaking to a packed room, German Vogue editor-in-chief Christiane Arp dismissed most of the criticism of German fashion as nonsense from people who'd never even seen a fashion show. And she announced the founding of an important industry group with herself at the helm.
Für den German Fashion Design Council zugesagt, die Präsidentin zu sein.
The German Fashion Design Council is just in its infancy, but there are high hopes that it will offer support and guidance for young designers here. A movement in that direction began this season with the Berliner Mode Salon, a program of presentations and installations from 18 German designers. It offered an alternative to the sometimes raucous main tent of Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week Berlin, filled to the brim daily with partiers and picture takers. On show in the more sedate Palais was a blend of experienced and newer designers, and those in the middle, like Berlin's Hien Li. Li's 5-year-old minimalist label for men and women has shown in the Fashion Week tent almost every season since being founded. This year, it was time for something new, the wood-paneled elegance of Kronprinzenpalais.
The tent is super, and I'm so happy that we have the Fashion Week in Berlin. Compare the tent to other Fashion Weeks, it's kind of a bit of a circus or something, you know. I mean, it's a tent. It's a different audience. So, and that's why I think it's nicer to have different locations as well. It makes it also more international, like in Paris or Milan. They also have different locations and not only one spot where all the designers are showing, so.
But for some local fashion labels, this step in the right direction is not quite the leap they need.
We are now in the top to show maybe in Paris for this season. Let's see how it works.
Odalie Thiboul is half of French-German design duo Augustin Thiboul. They're known for exquisitely crafting all-black confections from leather, lace, and wool, and are the closest thing the city has to couture. To survive, they need global reach and serious retailers.
But I think it's important to keep the advantages of both cities. So it's nice to do something here But at one point, if we want to make a step, maybe it's also nice to consider to get more international and still continue to do something in Berlin, but maybe with different approaches.
The city's Fashion Week is also impacted by where it falls on the schedule each year, this season between men's and couture. Journalists and buyers who manage to attend are dropping in breathless from Milan before racing off to Paris. Melissa Dreyer explains.
Berlin is also one of those first seat kind of places, so a lot of buyers, German buyers, when they are here, are not really in the mood to commit. They'd rather see what comes out of Milan, what comes out of Paris, what comes out of London, and then they'll think about it. And it's hard for our people to really afford being both places, but if they want to build even a national distribution, they often have to go show elsewhere.
Dreyer is a longtime expert on the German fashion industry and correspondent for influential U.S. trade paper Women's Wear Daily. She's also a founding member of the new German Fashion Design Council.
I mean, this is an exciting season because there are a lot of starts going on, and the work is ahead of us. But there are a lot of people who want to talk this market dead, say it's over. Certain people just don't think it's worth coming anymore. I think it's foolish. If German fashion has a positive image somehow, it will help everybody at every level of the market.
Berlin's young talents are moving that image along, especially Bobby Colade. Dreyer chose his migration-inspired collection as one of the best in her wrap-up of the week's shows. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Susan Stone.
And that's all we have time for on today's Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and to play you out, with all that furniture we heard about at the start of the show in mind, we have Folding Chair by Regina Spektor. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Come and open up your folding chair next to me. My feet are buried in the sand, and there's a breeze. There's a shadow, you can't see my eyes. And the sea is just a wetter version of the sky.